Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Colavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Celia Cutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, Mike Colomeco here. Welcome. This is Food Talk Season 2 on Heritage Radio Network. Great to be here. Got a good show today. Talk about a couple of things before I bring my guests on, but to keep you listening, I'm going to have in a couple of minutes Alan Salgan on the show. Covers the covers media, I guess, is what Alan does. He'll tell us what he does. But he wrote a hardback book a while back called From Scratch, The Uncensored History of the Food Network. It's now out on paperback, and it's great. It's an incredible read. Kind of draws you right into it. He must have done hundreds, if not more, interviews to do this, because it's really backstage. From day one, we'll talk about a network that's become ubiquitous now, but how it got started in the early 90s, a time I remember well. And after that, my next guest in studio will be Chef Jesse Shanker, who's got a couple of great restaurants in Manhattan, Reset, which opened a while back in Greenwich Village, Far West Village, and now, I'm drawing a blank on the second one. It's great. I'll remember it later on. It's in Midtown. He just opened it. But he's got a book out, and it's called All or Nothing, One Chef's Appetite for the Extreme. It's a real personal kind of tell-all about his life, his struggle with addiction early on, through his teenage years and his 20s, and how he came clean. It's great. It's really good. It's about a topic we should really talk more about, because there's a lot of problems out there these days with stuff like oxycodone and heroin and addiction. And my industry, the restaurant industry, is rife with drug and alcohol issues. I want to give a shout out. If you're listening to the show and you don't live in the metro area and you like it, you can find me on Create TV these days. We just went national last month on that PBS platform, so we're in 80% of the U.S. households. So go to your Create schedule. We're on 3 times a day, 6 days a week through the end of this month, and that'll repeat again, so that's kind of fun. We just shot a show yesterday for next season on wine bars. It was a great day. We were out all day long. It was one of those 12-hour shoots, me and my two trusty camera guys who I beat into the ground, dragging them around. It was 5 locations over the course of the day. We started with Laura Maniac, who you heard on this show a couple of weeks ago. She's a master sommelier. She's amazing. She was the youngest woman to ever become a master somm. If I'm not mistaken, one of the parts of the master somm exam, which I would find, and I think most people find, the most daunting, is you're given 6 bottles that are covered completely. You have no idea what they are. 3 reds and 3 whites. You have a couple of sommeliers across the table from you. They pour the wine into the glass, and you've got to guess the varietal, the grape type, the country of origin, and as if that wasn't enough, the vintage, which just absolutely sounds impossible to me. She passed that on her first go-around, so she's amazing. She's fun. She has 2 great wine bars in New York, Cork Buzz on 13th Street, 13 East 13th, which is a great sit-down wine bar with a really good menu. Wonderful young chef who spent 10 years working with Danielle Boulud, who's redoing the menu. The food's great. The wines are insane. And she has another little Cork Buzz in the Chelsea Market. That's great, too. We went up to Ardesia, which is in the West 50s, 52nd, between 10th and 11th, 5th year anniversary. Great wine bar, great chef, great team. They're going to open up another wine bar next month in Brooklyn. Then we went down to the Lower East Side to a place called 10 Bells on Broome Street. Wonderful organic biodynamic wine bar. So if you're into wine bars, hit me up on Facebook or whatever, and I'll give you a list of where we went and the addresses, because they were great. The bio-organic bar is great. It's 10 Bells. That's all they have. Every wine on their list, every wine that they're pouring is bio-organic. So if you wondered what that world was like, hop on the F train and find out. All right, let me go. We in the wings, we have Alan Salgan. Alan, are you there?
I am here.
Congratulations. So I don't know where, I never got a copy of the hardback, but I'm glad I got a copy of the paperback.
The paperback's got a nicer cover, and it has a spiffy new afterword, so I think you're lucky.
Well, there you go. So talk about this crazy thing. I mean, let's just go back to...
Wait, I want you to talk about your experience of Food Network first. I can answer all the questions, but...
I was never there. I was one of those who, for whatever reason, I do have experience, and it's funny because the our world is a small world, and I did radio with Donna Hanover when I was at WOR. I know David Rosengarten. I know Bill Boggs from New York Athletic Clubs. Josh Wesson was a sommelier at a restaurant called Breve, where I worked briefly as the chef. So we're Charlie Pinsky. At one point, Karen Katz tried to get me into the Food Network. As you know, Karen was Emerald's producer. But no, my only dealings with the Food Network was in 1999, one of my editor still and partner in this project, he's a cameraman, Kirk Sir, my neighbor in Maplewood at the time in New Jersey, had an idea to do a cooking show. I hated cooking shows because if you go back to the 90s, they were all the same thing.
Yeah.
So I said, let's do a show. I've never done TV, but I want to do a show that isn't being done yet. I know all the chefs in New York City. I know most of the chefs. Let's do a documentary-style show that takes the viewers backstage into restaurants in real time. So I'll be the lens that the public views the industry through, and we'll just – that's how we're going to do it. So we shot a 3-episode pilot, went to the Food Network. They were doing nothing like that at that time. Everything was in studio. I think Opetut might have been there then. I forget. I forget who I pitched, but it was a no-go. And then we went to PBS. And luckily, Ann Gorfinkel at Channel 13 liked what she saw, asked us to clean it up a bit so we could deliver them on PBS spec. We did. She aired them back in October of 2000, 3 weeks in a row, and the numbers just blew up. They re-aired them again in February, same thing, and then they asked me to do a series. So that was it. And then the only other time, Karen Katz watched my PBS series and thought I'd be great for TV Food Network. But, you know, you have to be – your timing has to be right with those guys, right? You know how that is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's – it's interesting. Yeah, you're – it's hard not to – you know, Bobby Flay told me that in the early days, the most important thing to get on Food Network was that you'd be able to reach there by subway.
Yeah, I read the quote.
Yeah. So, you know, the networks – and you know, what you're describing with David Rosengarten and Josh Wesson, the only game in town was PBS back before Food Network with, you know, the Frugal Gourmet and obviously Julia and Pinsky, who represented a lot of people who were – Pierre Franey, who were doing shows. And so it wasn't thought to be a viable business. Nobody thought it was a good idea. This was when we were going from 30 cable channels back up to the coming 500-channel universe, it was described as. Of course, now we're in the 5-gajillion-channel universe. And people were trying all kinds of crazy ideas. A psychology network was floated, which probably would have helped me. You know, a pet channel, but it turns out pets don't make their own purchase decisions about cruise vacations and automobiles. So, you know, so this was an idea that was floated, you know, in Providence with the cable company there.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. I mean, it's this little tiny Colony TV and Progo or whatever they're called.
Projo, yeah. Projo. They were the corporate, the Providence Journal newspaper company, which also was in the cable business. And, yeah, and even Johnson & Wales, the cooking school, you know, sort of gave a little germ of the idea, and it took root with this guy, Joe Langan, and ultimately they hired Reese Schoenfeld. And that's the, you know, the story the book tells is this unlikely beginning in the early 90s when, you know, there were newspaper articles saying, well, now that the 80s are over, the celebrity chef fad is over. You know, and even Florence Fabricant penned such an article. So she's great, Flo Fab, but she's not always right.
And she's rarely wrong. She's really, really good. Yeah, yeah. So August 16th, 1993 is the launch date, right?
That was when I think they sort of realized they were really going to make it work. The first official day that, you know, was the press release day of the launch was November 23rd, 1993, because they wanted to start Thanksgiving week, and they couldn't start the Monday of that week, the 22nd, because it was the 30th anniversary of the JFK assassination.
It's media. It's all media. And the early teams, it's funny because I knew, again, I was at WOR for 6 years doing a radio show called Food Talk down there. I was, I guess, the fourth host after Arthur Schwartz invented the show. And then it was Rocco and Tyler and then me until it rode into its sunset when Clear Channel took over. But, I knew Donna would tell stories about those early days, too. So they were really just throwing stuff against a wall to figure out what would work.
Well, Donna's show, because Reese Schonfeld, the president of the network, was the same guy that had started CNN, so he wanted a daily news show that he saw as the sort of hub of the network, just like in CNN, that news desk. Yeah. Think of that as the hub. And, to him, finding foodies was not going to be a problem. The problem was finding talented people he could speak to and who understood what he was talking about in the business of television. And Donna, whose husband was about to win, the mayorship of New York.
Rudy Giuliani, correct.
Right. It was Donna Hanover Giuliani, people who remembers. It's 10, 15 years ago now. And so they had this daily news show, and with David Rosengarten, it was totally amateurish. And yet, I have to say, when you look at that show now, they were reporting on, things like organic foods and, growth hormone, and I actually think now would be the time for that
show.
It's
funny, as you're mentioning,
the sophistication has grown.
As you're mentioning this, I'm thinking that's actually a great show because you could do issues. I mean, we have a radio station here out in Brooklyn, Heritage Radio, that has nearly 50 different programs 7 days a week that are airing on nothing but the topic of food, farming, beverage, hunting, all the issues. And yeah, I mean, there's pick up. Anything, any day. There's that would be a great idea for today. But anyway, who knows? It's not going to happen.
I love coming. I've been on about 10 of those shows out there, and I love coming to Roberta's and filming, and just I'm so overwhelmed. That's why I'm sitting 5 miles from you in Manhattan having this conversation. But yeah, and you're right. I did a lot of interviews. There was a lot of people circling around this network over the 20 years, and it was really Emeril Lagasse with Emeril Live in '97.
Bingo.
That was the first show a lot of people heard about because it was showbiz.
Yep. Yep, it was big. Karen Katz was his producer, and she told me a great story that one day she was, I guess she was at Nickelodeon or she was in the universe of television somewhere, and she had been invited for lunch, and it was these three other women who were Food Network executives and a guy at the table who she'd never seen before, and the talk was about possibly doing a show, and the guy at the table who was so quiet and so shy was Emeril, and that was sort of the beginning of her saying, okay, what are we going to do with this? And yeah, he was their marquee player, and I guess towards the end, as it was told, relayed to me, once he had that $1 million 3-year deal, and they began to want to switch directions, it got to the point where there was no love lost between him and management. Their lawyers talked. It was like couples going through a divorce. They did not talk. It was you talk to my lawyers talk to your lawyers.
Well, I opened the book with Emeril getting canceled, and he did have a 10-year run.
Yep.
And by the way, that meeting between Karen, his show had been on a year in 97, 98, and they didn't like the producer, and so they brought Karen in. And that meeting was at the same the Mark Hotel where Emeril stayed because he liked the bacon. One of those details I unearthed.
Good.
And they'd had a 10-year run, and Emeril, had changed. The way he looked had changed. He wasn't, young and thin anymore, and when you think about it, that was 2007 that they canceled Emeril Live. And at that time, Guy Fieri had just won Food Network Star in 2006. They were on a winning streak. They thought they could get rid of Emeril and there would just be more and more stars to come, just like there had been the last 6 or 7 years with, Rachel Ray arriving and Giada and Paula Deen, the Barefoot Contessa. They were wrong. Almost from that moment when Emeril Live was canceled, which, yes, was taking up an hour of primetime every night, they have kind of lost their way creatively.
Well, it's true, but from doing television, and
everything has its day.
Everything has its day, and you get new people coming in and new people in acquisition, and they're all gunning for something, and nobody knows exactly what. Right? So what's the demographic? Do we want women over men? Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
What's the age group? Oh, it's getting too old. Emeril's demo's too old for us. We want somebody younger. I mean, you just never. It's like constantly you're on the slippery slope.
Well, but. Two things. First of all, they were taking chances when they weren't making a lot of money, and that's where you got Emeril Live, and that's where you got Good Eats. Who would, there's a scene in the book where Alton, nobody knows who he is, Alton Brown is shooting this show on film where he's drawing on a live cow with chalk. in a field to show where the cuts of the beef are, and people are looking at this going, what is this? No one's going to watch this, you know? Crazy chances are what yield big rewards. And as you get more and more fearful because you're making more money and there's stockholders, things change. Yeah. And I have no idea what the second point I was going to make is.
Well, no, it's funny. Go ahead. Continue.
Look at Heritage. You guys have, like you say, there's you know, shows that are concerned with foraging and different kinds of sea moss and whatever. That world in which Heritage can exist and flourish was created by Food Network. They created the market, the start of the intelligence in a generation that evolved into wanting to know every possible thing about food. And the network has, you know, basically stepped off that train sometime in about 2005.
To be what? To become what? Because that was about the point when there was, I mean, you can't, they made stars out of, I mean, the list just goes on. I mean, Mario Batali, he married well to begin with, that doesn't hurt, but he's a great chef. I mean, Mario would have done well without the Food Network, but with it, it was like he was put in orbit with rocket launchers. Tony Bourdain got his start on the TV Food Network. Bobby Flay, you know, hardworking New York chef, always thought, well, I mean, these guys, they've built empires. And of course, not to mention Rachel Ray and Paula Deen, they've minted millionaires, and that's kind of the attraction, I think, for people to go on the Cooking Channel and then eventually the Food Network if they can cross that bridge at some point. But yeah, they've made stars out of people. But at some point, it seemed to me like they were trying to de-emphasize the chef thing. They didn't want, you know, that you try to tell that story about when Mario is in Italy and he's filming in Italy and he's going around to these great little trattorias, and one of the episodes they're going to do tripe, and he got a call from New York and they said no one, everyone hates tripe, don't do it. There just seemed to be this blowback towards high concept, and to my mind it was just a move to low, like just the middle somewhere, just, I don't want to say mediocrity,
fear. You know, fear and this is emanating from the corporate parent in Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, and it's an old story, and it's unfortunate. And they were a victim of their own success also, because after 9/11, which is really when it took off, you know, that the horrible events of 9/11 created this hunger for, you know, a way back to the simple pleasures of, like, the kitchen and family, you know, the cocooning instinct. And so they started putting personalities people could identify with rather than who could make the best bechamel sauce.
Right.
And so that's where you get, you know, Rachel's show debuted, 30 Minute Meals, in November 2001, just by chance. And that blew up the ratings, just like your debut on PBS did. And that's when they start looking around and they give Paula Deen a chance, who had been shunted off for years. Okay, maybe people do want fried chicken and, you know, buttery pies, and all these neighborly kind of figures. So, you know, where they are now is everyone complains there's nothing but competition on. The question is there space? You know, it's just like with rock and roll. You know, there used to be five big bands that sold all the records. You know, is there space now for one channel that is broad, or has the interest in food become so diffuse and complex that, yeah, we just need a million spin-offs so everyone can find what they want?
Which is also true in the broader sense, because you cover the media. I mean, who would have thought that there would be 11 shows about gold mining or pawn shop stores or Alaska? I mean, where does this stuff come from?
Well, but look, where it comes from is one channel takes a chance first.
Correct.
You know, and look at History Channel. They had Pawn Stars and the Duck Dynasty. I mean, who would think that would work? Well, it works. And what's happened with Food Network, like you said, they were producing all their shows, you know, in their own studios because it was cheap. And they have since stopped almost all of their own production. They now rent out their own studio. And they are simply, like every other network, waiting for producers and, you know, agents to walk in the door, to sit in the conference room and have a meeting with the next high concept. But a Scripps network, you know, just like you said, Bourdain started there, and then they told him, you know, stop traveling so much. We want you to go to more barbecue joints. And he told them to go to hell. You know, if Duck Dynasty walked into a Scripps network, they wouldn't even sit through the whole meeting. Get out of here.
Yeah, no, it's true, because I've worked with a couple different production companies over the years, and I've worked with some young guys last couple of seasons, and they're trying to talk to the TV Food Network all the time, and they'd go in meetings and just walk out scratching their heads, because what are you looking for? We've got what's a new idea? It's kind of like, we want a new idea. Actually, we want to redo these ideas that are currently working. You know, it's
yes, with the same old face.
Give me a competition.
They, you know, instead of, they used to have a show called Chef du Jour, and that's how Mario Batali got on, and, you know, even I think Bourdain did a stint on that, and, you know, you would get a whole week of shows to see if you could do it. Now you get, like, 30 seconds on Chopped, and if you, you know, if you screw up your Brunois, you're out. Yeah. And there's no chance to develop anybody, and they're running, you know, we can complain and complain. They're doing the best they can, but I don't think, you know, the story is, where is the creative person? Nobody likes a new idea when they first hear it, because it's weird. And you have to have some kind of, and the guy that's sort of well-known in the business, Bob Tushman, yeah, who I sort of call out in the book and has been called out elsewhere, you know, he's kind of known as the main guy who wrinkles his nose and says no to new ideas. He's you know, but he hangs on there because he's the guy that found Rachel Ray.
That's the key. That's the lock. That's it, huh?
It seems to be. I mean, I think they're scared. You know, they are trying to sell. Ken Lowe, the president of the CEO of Scripps, the parent company, is going around trying to sell the whole empire. He sees what's happening with cable TV and knows it's falling apart a little bit. And I think they may just want to keep the ship as right as they can, as long as they can, and not try to take too many chances. It's a shame because it is a great opportunity. And I think I don't know, but if it was me, I'd rather go down fighting with new ideas than with another show starring the very well-coiffed Jeffrey Zakarian.
And Jeffrey, I mean, I'll give him his props. As a chef, he's a pro. He's a New York veteran.
Absolutely.
I've known him forever. I mean, Jeffrey and I were actually competing for jobs eons ago when McNally was opening up the Royalton, and he's a star. But yeah, it's funny. I mean, Jeffrey's restaurant empire went bankrupt a couple of years back. Thank God for the TV Food Network.
You asked Jeffrey, and I saw Bobby Flay lead a panel down at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival asking Jeffrey, if you had your choice, would you rather make your money from TV exclusively or restaurants exclusively?
TV.
He said TV.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's clean money. It's more money. It's a hell of a lot less work and risk. I mean, Jeffrey's businesses went under. I think there was a lawsuit with the waiters over it. It was one of those horrible things where he had to declare bankruptcy to shield himself from what was going to happen next. So yeah, they've made him. Alex Guarnaschelli, I love her. I remember when Alex was a struggling chef at a little restaurant called Butter in the East Village, and she was shopping at the Pioneer grocery store, you know, to buy food to get her mise en place to get through service at night. Mom's a brilliant editor in the food world, but, you know,
she's still wonderfully irascible.
And Alex, who knew? I mean, Alex went through some really funny, hard times, and now she's got a sinecure, appears as a judge on, I guess it's Chopped or whatever that stuff's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but you're absolutely right. I think when my takeaway from the meetings that I've had getting close to the Food Network was what you said is they have a certain Nielsen number, whatever that number is, 1.8, 2.1, whatever. It's like a heartbeat. If they can keep that number all day long through prime time and, you know, into the evening hours, that's all they care about.
Well, the job of the Food Network is not to teach us how to cook better or enlighten us in any way. The job of the Food Network is to sell us Corollas, breath mints, and cruise vacations.
It's true. And I guess that's why I'm stuck on PBS, but I like the platform. PBS gives me a lot of latitude to do what I want and get
stories. The model on PBS is
trust me.
Raise all your money in advance.
Yeah,
it's complicated.
Yeah, they get the show on bed. The acquisition fee is zero. It's a donut. Yeah, no one gets paid. But back in the day, so I'm sure you know, I mean, Charlie Pinsky was a really successful guy who put that Spain show together and pocketed a ton of money. It was a little easier then, and of course Pinsky's got connections, and I think Jeff Drummond and Nat Katz, those two guys at A La Carte, who had a bunch of hits. I mean, they were, you talk about not wanting to take chances. When they first brought Lydia's show, the pilot, when they first brought that pilot to Channel 13, Eileen Opetut was in charge of programming. Garrison Botts was her assistant at the time. This was way back, like late 80s, early 90s, whatever that time frame was, before she was on air. And I don't know why Jeff Drummond thought this would be good, but they brought this show that looks very much like the show still looks. It was Lydia in her kitchen at her home, kind of in a grandmotherly style, preparing a meal, and the two programmers looked at each other and just said, "Who's going to watch this?" I mean, she's 50 years old. She's going bald. She's overweight. Yeah. You know, it's slow. Who was going to watch this? Well, but they were hungry for content, and these guys already had a track record with Jacques Pepin's show and other shows, so they took it. And it's become the biggest show on PBS.
You know, with the music business, there's so many parallels. You know, food just comes 30 years later. But, you know, if you got signed by the right label in 1970 and you just got put in the right pocket, you know, with the right radio stations playing your single and the right PR, you were a star. That's what it took, you know, at least for one album.
It's true.
And if you got Jeff Drummond, who obviously did Julia Child's later shows, yep, The Frugal Gourmet, yep, you know, if you got Jeff to do it, and he called the right person at WGBH in Boston, you had a cooking show, and that's how it was. And it, you know, it's like everything now. If you're not really awesome and you don't catch a million people clicking on something in the first 5 minutes, I'm not even complaining. This is life. This is where it is. And this is the game that we all are playing. How do we survive? You know, how many shows have you got, and how many networks? You're doing like seven things.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's fun, you know, but it's also there's not a lot as much time as there used to be for, you know, long expense account lunches.
No, it's done. It's over. And now the push to, you know, because I've got to sell ad space, right? I mean, or underwrite, whatever you want to call it. You know, the push towards being on social media, to having an Instagram presence, a Twitter hat, you know, to how many friends you have on Facebook. It never ends. It's like when you think you've ridden the last big wave and you can relax on the beach. No, it's paddle out time all over again with media. It never ends.
Which is why, what's still one of the biggest pleasures?
What's that, for me?
Well, I'll tell you what mine is, standing in the kitchen and cooking.
Yeah, well, you know,
I'm a media, as you said, I'm a media reporter. Yeah. I didn't come at this as a foodie, really, or a food writer. You know, I've become really knowledgeable, and I did go to Berkeley in the 80s, and so I was exposed to all that stuff. But, you know, it's still ultimately the reason I think people fell in love with Food Network, and even with Lydia and those, you know, old goofy shows, was there's something really sweet about it. It's a very old kind of form of entertainment, watching somebody cook. It hits us in our archetypes. And I think at its best, that's what Food Network still does, which is why I don't like, you know, things like Cutthroat Kitchen. And, you know, when I'm in the kitchen, I don't even need music almost. I don't need the TV. I don't need anything. There's something just wonderfully meditative about it. And I like the shows that somehow evoke in me that same feeling I get where, you know, I can't cook and talk at the same time. And I'm a good talker, you know, and it's amazing that some people can. And I just love that, the sweetness of the act. And so, you know, turn it all off and cook yourself a meal.
I'm started cooking at 13. I've been in love with this business since I was a little kid. So, yeah, my favorite times are, like, Thursday nights in New York, I don't go out to eat. I eat out the other three or four nights. And I've got a great little apartment downtown facing uptown views from Grand Street, Empire State Building, City Court. Great, a big eating kitchen, a nice little stove, and I just love cooking, looking out the window. Only I blast music. And my trip down to Cape May, that's where I live on the weekends, I've got a ridiculous stereo, so my weekends are just built around what am I cooking for dinner Saturday, Sunday, and what's the three-hour playlist. Simple stuff.
I argue that as TVs have gotten bigger, you know, and more high def, it's almost like looking into a kitchen. Except, you know, on a lot of those kitchens you see through the screen, the cook is better looking, you know, and the food often comes out better than it's sort of like porn, you know. What's happening on the screen is usually better than what's happening in the room.
It's a great book. Is my next guest in studio, by the way? Gotcha. All right. My guest has been Alan Salkin. If you have not read this book, you really have to, because the TV Food Network, like it or not, hate it, whatever, it's a huge cultural presence. It has launched the careers of dozens of household names these days, some of them are still on the network. Others have gone on to launch and carve out space on other networks and in media, and it's absolutely behind the scenes. It's part gossip. It's all fact. You've done your homework. It's a great read. It's a wonderful read about this sort of this institution on television now, the TV Food Network and the Cooking Channel. I guess they're B brand. But thanks for writing the book. It was a pleasure having you on, and maybe we'll get you back on and in studio at some point 6 months from now to talk about some specifics from it, because it's a great story.
I love to come there and have some free pizza. And thank you so much. And the book makes a nice gift, people.
Alan Salkin. The name of the book is From Scratch: The Uncensored History of the Food Network. Available in paperback, and it includes a new foreword and afterward. Thank you so much. Take care. So folks, you're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break here at the bottom, like we always do, and give a shout out to some of the people that help make this show possible. And then I'm going to bring my next guest in studio, Jesse Shanker, great chef who's got a great story to tell. We're going to talk about his most recent book, his first book, All or Nothing. And eventually we're going to segue to his restaurants in the city here. So stay tuned. We'll be back with Jesse Shanker right after this. Hey folks, Mike Kalameko here. When I want to make great tomato sauce at home, this really starts with the best. For years and years and years, I've been using Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. You know, it's funny. I use them because they had this great reputation as being a great tomato. I cut them against other samples of tomatoes when I had my restaurant back in the day and was a chef that was in charge of purchasing and just thought they were great. So I knew in my mouth that I liked them. But I had to see why. So, about 7 or 8 years ago, I went on a trip to the San Marzano region, which sits just outside of Naples, Italy, really in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. It looked nothing like I expected. Most of the farms are small farms, small family farms. They've got a really long season, about 5 or 6 seasons, actually. Starts in April or May and runs through October, November. Beautiful volcanic soil, incredibly clean water, just great tomatoes. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency, which guarantees the traceability. So when you're looking for great tasting canned tomatoes, look no further. Spend the extra couple of pennies. Look for that bright yellow Cento can. Yeah, it's the best. It's what I use. It's what great chefs use in their kitchens because, frankly speaking, there's nothing like it. Hey, folks, Mike Kalameko here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, trying to make money in the restaurant business. So, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. Commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. A couple of years ago, for the first time, I got to visit Portugal. Don't ask me why I never had. I'd been all around it. Been to France, been to Spain, been to Italy, been all over Europe, but for some reason not Portugal. Well, I'm glad I went. I knew they had great seafood, and I knew they had great viticulture, and I knew the food culture was great. I mean, just look at the neighborhood they live in. But what I didn't know was about the wines. And when we think of Portugal, we think of port wine, which is true. The wines that are port made on the Douro River is an astonishing thing, unique to the region. But what I didn't realize was Portugal has over 250 indigenous varietals grown there. Just kind of blew me away. So the microclimates were amazing. You had arid, you had dry, you had elevations, you have coastal, you had some kind of steep mountainous where they had to manufacture on a terrace. It's really great. Super friendly, food-friendly wines, really good white wines of all types of styles, and really beautiful red wines that work with it. And most importantly for me, these are the wines that pair really well with food. I don't drink wine as a standalone. I drink it with meal. So if you're looking for the new world of wines, try Portuguese wines. I think they're going to have their day. I fell in love with them. I'm going to be filming there in a couple of weeks, actually, to close out my PBS season. So I'll let you know when that show airs. You'll learn a lot more about it. But you can visit them also or join Wines of Portugal USA on Facebook or Twitter at WPTUSA, Wines of Portugal.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and this is Mike Kalameka. We're back live in the studio with Chef Jesse Shanker. Two restaurants in town. Reset is the original place that kind of launched him into orbit. Corner of 12th and something, not Washington. 12th
Greenwich Street.
12th and Greenwich. Great, great restaurant. Great restaurant. Great kitchen. Really tight menu. And the Gander, which is, give me the address, Jess.
15 West 18th.
15 West 18th, new addition. It's a wonderful, wonderful addition to that sort of Union Square-ish neighborhood. I was there for dinner a while back, and I just like to tits it out, hit it. Over the fence. It was great. Great. Wonderful menu of kind of like eclectic American. I mean, I still get over. What was the salad that had the ranch dressing? Was that the sweetbread one?
The calamari.
Calamari.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like such a mashup. It was so good. I mean, I want to eat that like every day.
It's one of those salads you want to eat every day. I eat it. I'm known for eating it.
It's stupidly good. We're here to talk about this book, and I'm going to give it a preface. So the name of the book, Chef, let's call him Jesse. Jesse Shanker wrote it. That's S-C-H-E-N-K-E-R. Name of the book's All or Nothing. It just came out on something or other.
September 30th.
Yeah, September 30th on Day Street. And it's his life. It's really a tell-all book, and it's great because lots of times people talk about, you know, their successes and how they got to be great at what they did and not about their DUIs or the time that they did this or they fucked up. This is a story about how life can get messy and drugs. And it's dealing with addiction at a time when our culture just seems to be turning a blind eye to it. Like in America, it seems to me that we're, you know, the war on drugs has turned out to be a big joke. Drugs are everywhere, and certain classes of drugs, the opioids, have just blown up in the last 10 years and have ruined a shit ton of people's lives. The New York Times has done some great work on it, but I know firsthand of kids that were friends of my sons, and everyone has these stories of a kid that started doing one drug, took another drug, discovered OxyContin or one of those opioids, which are incredibly addicting and then get really expensive, which leads to heroin and basically the end of your life. We all have these stories. So, Jess, talk to me about when you first started getting high. When did the whole thing start? And let me guess, because you and I are, I mean, reading this book, and I'm like, I was about this close to being where you were, and I just, like, made a left-hand turn
right.
At one point. And thank God these things weren't around. I mean, I never went to the opium, heroin, morphine shit, but was that close.
Right.
Back in the day. So you were, let me guess, 13 years old, junior high.
Yeah, 12.
12?
12.
You beat me by a year, you bastard. So talk about that. Just talk about this, because this is interesting. So you got into drugs as a young kid. You're not even a teenager.
Not a young teenager. I was 12 years old. I used to come spend my summers upstate. I'm originally from South Florida, and I would go up to New Paltz and Poughkeepsie area and hang out with my family. And my older cousin, 16 at the time, was like my older brother. Exactly. That's how it started. we went to a rave one night. Everyone's around smoking pot, and sure enough, I hit that joint, and it was like this fucking light.
And you loved it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Oh, my God. It just, that was
Do
it.
Do you remember the first time you got high?
I remember.
Me too. I literally remember where I was, who I was with, and I remember the feeling of my universe expanding.
Expanding.
It was like, wow. Yes. I like this space.
Yeah. And for me, I should have known because it turned to self-medication immediately. Like, I think looking back now as an adult, I could say I was just an anxious kid. But at the time, I didn't know I was anxious. I was just doing – I just couldn't sit still. I was rambunctious. I just couldn't be with myself. My leg was always tapping. I was had to be the center of attention, involved in everything. And I was just very – I just couldn't be. But when I smoked pot, it was like, oh, man, calm down. Everything's good, you know. And it really started – my first drug was really cooking because, like, when I go back to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, being in the kitchen was my safe zone and, like, where I felt peace. But the substance, obviously, is just so much stronger. It just kind of – you know, it's like that parallel run of like working in restaurants, dishwashing, McDonald's, smoking pot, line cooking at local restaurants, you know, and the pot turning to pain pills and LSD. And it was just all parallel until the drugs just kind of ate up that passion for food.
And sadly, in our business, you know, I'll try and tell the truth on my PBS show, although I don't go into dirty details, but drugs and alcohol are rife in
Huge.
The restaurant industry, both front and back of the house.
Yep. Huge.
Huge. I mean, and it's always been so when I came to New York in the 80s, the drug of choice was blow. And I mean, there was luckily I had come to New York to sort of reinvent me. Because the guy I had been for the 10 years before that was a train wreck. It was
right.
Quaaludes and all that shit. And I came to New York and I was the straight guy in the kitchen. I was going to the boxing gym, going to the karate dojo every day, going to bed early, getting up and working out. But I mean, there were guys doing lines all day and night long in these kitchens.
Yeah, for sure.
So what? How? Because you were at the beginning of these oxycodone, whatever these classes of drugs are.
Yeah, I mean,
they were new.
No, they were totally new. I got in before the epidemic, really. I would say 98, 99 is when I first got linked
up
to
oxy. How hardly addictive are they?
Oh, my God. I mean, well, I feel like you got to be a certain, you know, you got to have the gene for that kind of stuff. Some people like, you know, I talk about poppy in the gateway.
Yeah.
I know plenty of people who smoke pot. They smoke pot their whole lives.
Nothing
and that's
happened.
It.
Yes.
And they don't have the gene. But there's people like me.
Yeah.
That you smoke the pot and eventually it just doesn't work anymore. It's not enough. It's not strong enough. And you got to move on to something else. So for me, it was my sister got her wisdom teeth pulled. I was like 16 years old. I saw the bottle, the fucking orange, you know, bottle next to the bed. I looked at it. You know, I took one, oxycodone or Percocet, popped one. 20 minutes later, my belly warms. This blanket of love is over me. And I'm just like, oh, my God. I was in heaven. So I chased that feeling. So I did the recon. I was like, opiates, opiates, opiates. That was my thing. I had messed with the Xanax, the Valium. I hated it. I woke up places the next day, didn't know what I did. It wasn't something that I liked. I didn't feel like I was in control. And I was cooking at a restaurant in Boca Raton. And one of the line cooks was hooked on Percocets. And, you know, so from one day he came to work. He was sweating. He was physically sick. I didn't know what dope sick meant at the time. I didn't know what physical withdrawal looked like. So I see this guy sweating, panicking, like, hey, can you get anything? So I called my pot dealer, and he says, I don't have anything, but I got these things called OCs. You want to try one? And I'm like, so I look at him. I say, OCs. He goes, no, I never heard of it. I don't want it. So we're like, no, I'll pass, you know, and we hang up, not knowing what we just passed on. But that was stuck in my brain that weekend. I kept saying, well, what are these OC things? What are these OC things? So I call him back. He said, they give it to cancer patients and people with broken backs. I said, I'm coming over now. It was 16 Percocets in one pill.
That's the strength of it.
That's what an OC80 was. And they actually had 160s at the time. And they banned those because people were dying from them. They actually stopped making them.
And that – so at some point your body's desire – what's the word I'm trying – you need more.
Yeah, you're
you build up a resistance.
You build up resistance
really quickly.
Oh no,
Mr.
very
wasn't
quickly.
Rush Limbaugh addicted to this shit at one point?
He was.
The big fat fuck.
I mean,
Big Russ, Mr. High. I mean, he at one point he had to go to rehab. So that drug at some point you can't afford it anymore, and it leads to all the other nonsense.
Well, for me, it was you know, oxys. I was like, I'll take a quarter. I'll take a half. Eventually, half turns into three quarters turns into a whole one, turns into swallowing, it turns into chewing, it turns into snorting it, you know. And, yeah, eventually it just got too expensive, and I started stealing from my family, my friends.
This is amazing because this is – I mean, we have – I firsthand, we know these stories. So literally – I met your dad.
Yes.
The nicest guy in the world,
very,
you know.
Very cool,
like
man.
Like a saint. But at some point, that's how your mind is – as an addict. It doesn't matter. There are no lines you won't cross.
It's a disease. I mean, it really is. Yeah. Just like a diabetic needs insulin, I mean, addicts need certain things to kind of stay focused and stay clean, so to speak. And, you know, it's when it consumes you and you're in it, you have no conscience. Like, you wake up and it's all you think about. I mean, I think about the rat in the cage test where they had the mouse, the liquid cocaine on one side and the maize and the food and the water on the other, and the mouse kept going back to the coke until it died. You know, and like it's physically, physiologically, things are happening you can't control. I mean, you hurt the people you love, not because you don't love them or, you know, you're just caught up in the disease of addiction. And it doesn't discriminate. I mean, like you said, everybody knows somebody who's got a kid or a family or a sibling or a husband or, yeah, or a coworker that's suffering from the addiction, whether it's alcohol or pills or coke or.
And in our market, we're doing this out of New York, and I mean, Staten Island's like the epicenter for part of this heroin problem.
Right.
It's led out of the opioids, and I got friends in Long Island that live in the best neighborhoods whose kids have run into the same shit. I mean, these are the guys going into these pharmacies in Long Island with a gun, ready to almost kill.
Yes.
Holding up a pharmacy with a gun, give me all the opioids you have.
Right.
That's insanity.
It's insanity.
So for you, I mean, everyone talks about this, there was that moment, and I guess it was it a hotel room? It was July. By this point, you're homeless.
Yes.
You'd been arrested.
Yes.
Your parents weren't talking to you.
Right.
Or there, if they did, there was only one thing. Hey, mom, it's me. Go to rehab. Click.
Yes.
That was it. How long were you out on the streets?
My parents basically threw me out in I think it was April of 2002, and I didn't see them again.
2 years?
It was just over 2 years.
And just living like a bum.
I was living like a bum. I mean, I literally walked out of the door of my parents' house with a backpack and a handful of my mother's jewelry in my pocket, and went to a pawn shop, got cash, saw the dope man. I basically went from, you know, drug dealer to other people that are getting high, people's houses, until I ran out of money and they would throw me out. And, you know, eventually I was at a place after bouncing around for probably like 6 to 8 months, where I was standing in Deerfield Beach. I'll never forget the moment. I was on Hillsborough Boulevard and A1A, right by the Island Water Sports, and there's a 7-Eleven and there's a payphone. And I remember getting on the phone and calling my uncle and telling him what's going on and begging him to take me to rehab or somewhere. He said, Jesse, I can't help you. I called my ex-girlfriend. She said, I can't help you. Call your parents. My parents wanted to have anything to do with me. No one in my family did, none of my friends. I hung up that phone and I said, holy shit, where am I going to sleep tonight? And I literally just went over to a couple of the bums that sit on the corner with their brown bags drinking their Steel Reserves, and just sat down next to them. And basically from that point till July 04,
that was it.
I was homeless. I mean, meter rooms, Burger King boxes, you know, behind parks, on the beach, wherever I could. Once in a while, if I'd pull a heist or get some money, maybe I'd buy an efficiency for a week.
And the robbery, I mean, there was nothing, there was no line that wouldn't cross. I mean, even that scene where we won't go into it, where you meet the pimp and...
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you're just... That's where your brain
anything
is.
And everything that you can imagine, I did it.
Yeah. 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 And then there's the day that you wake up. And where was it? Did I have the month right? Was it a July
day? It was July.
You woke up, called mom, called... And you got busted. So you tell the story.
Well, I originally got arrested on the clock at a restaurant I was working at in Pompano. I bought, like... 100 oxys from an undercover cop. I got totally, you know, it was, I mean, a whole scenario. It's too long to get into, but so from there, I had to come clean with my parents what was going on, attorney, rehab long term. And through everything, I was able to get 5 years probation. And they tried to nail me with like trafficking OxyContin, which is a crazy, like, it's like a 30 mandatory minimum thing. So I got 5 years probation. And after my parents had threw me out all that time on the street, I stopped showing up to my probation office. So there was a warrant out for my arrest.
So you're a violation.
Yes. Total violation. So between, you know, I mean, every time I thought I hit a bottom, like this trap door would just shoot down, it would be worse. And so basically what happened, it came to, by July, I had overdosed, I'd been smoking crack, shooting coke, shooting dope, all skinny, you know, abscess in my arms, just totally rotted.
You're not dead.
I'm lucky I'm not dead. And I'd been scheming and scamming every day to get by. And finally, when I woke up, I came on some long bender. I was in Orlando off some crazy bender, and, I woke up and I was physically withdrawn. My bones hurt. I was skinny. I didn't know where I was going to go. I ran out of money. I knew I had to be out of the efficiency the following day. And I just started to, like, I just realized, like, I didn't want this anymore. Like, it wasn't fun. It wasn't self-medicating anymore. The anxiety was worse. And, like, I think I would hit so much pain, and I, like, my head, like, hit against the ground so hard that it was like I finally had woken up. I was like, I don't want this. So I respected my parents' wishes, and I hadn't called them because they always said drugs are family, and I had chose drugs consciously. And at that moment, I said, I don't want this anymore. I'm calling my parents. Picked up the phone. My mom answers. She hears my voice. She hangs up on me. I call back a minute later. My dad picks up. He says, Jesse, I can't help you. Go to a hospital. And he hangs up on me. I started bawling like a baby. I mean, I'm crying, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just like, I said, God, please help. And I'm not a religious man. I don't, I mean, I grew up Jewish, but I didn't know, God, this, that. I'm just desperate. So I had no choice. I went out that night. I kind of did what I had to do. I went into a bad neighborhood. I mean, I used to go into trailer parks and rip the AC units out of the windows and literally walk miles with them to this place in Martin Luther King where this guy had a he literally just opened his window and he'd give you $20 for something or 50. I think I got $25 for an AC unit, you know, chipping hammers, you name it, you know,
whatever.
Home Depot now nails their chipping hammers down because of guys like me. You used to be able to just walk out with them.
It's ridiculous.
So long story short is I was coming out of Martin Luther King Boulevard and down to Fort Lauderdale, and I saw a police drive by. And he started waving his lights, going, woo, woo, you know. And right. Instead of normally running like I would have,
right.
I sat on the curb.
Take me.
Take me. I surrendered, man. I sat there. The cop comes up. He gets out of the car. What are you doing in this neighborhood? White kid like you. I said, like, what the fuck do you think I'm doing here? I said, there's definitely a warrant for my arrest. I gave him my real name.
Yeah, he's my social security number. Putting me in the back seat.
Man. He said, sure enough, he calls it in. He comes back. You're right. Stand up. Put your cuffs, you know, turn around. He puts the cuffs on my hand. I remember the cold metal on my wrist. I remember the feeling. Mm. I started to smile. And like.
So you went through withdrawal in jail.
Withdrawal in jail. I said, I'm getting my parents back, my family back. I was locked up for 6 months. I was in two facilities. I got I requested a transfer to the Conti facility, which was a facility that had two. The kitchen was one. The kitchen was there, and two. There was a rehab program within the jail. So I went to a 90-day program in the jail, and at night they'd come and bust me over, chain link us together, and we'd go to this main kitchen, and we would cook for all the inmates. And I remember when I got back in that kitchen, I smelled those smells and that hood and the sweat on my face. Like that was it. I flicked the switch. I never looked back.
Never, so no relapses.
No relapses, day at a time.
And you're, and I know this. I'm going to ask it, so you can answer it for the audience. But you're no drugs, no alcohol.
No
nothing.
Drugs, no alcohol, nothing.
Period. And that has to be it.
That's it. I can't. If I take, and no mood or mind. I won't even take a Benadryl or a sleeping aid. Nothing. I mean, if I feel a little mood or mind altered, I'm not a Mickey Mouse addict. I spin out of control.
So that same drive, and this is the point of the book.
Yeah.
That same drive, that same obsessive drive. You talk about that eating at that sushi restaurant on 6th Avenue that you can't see in the window. It's got a little
soda, yeah.
Soda. You're having a meal with soda with your wife and then you're going home and you don't sleep because you're thinking about that meal, about those flavors. That so all of that energy, that obsession, you simply turn that light to food.
I did. I turned it. I basically So rehab, I got into a work release program after 6 months in this therapeutic community, which was out of control. After 4 months of being in there, they let you go out and look for a job. So you can only work by day. So I had worked in great restaurants all through Broward County and Dade County and had a great resume. So going out and getting a job was a no-brainer. I went out. I basically went to this place in Fort Lauderdale. I said to the chef, I'm in a work release program. I can only work daytimes. I've worked for A, B, and C. He goes, can you be here tomorrow? I said, sure. So he told me to be there at 9. I showed up at 7. You know, and like that, it just flipped for me. It was like I was grilling. I mean, I was grilling burgers at a restaurant for lunch at a tavern and tossing fries and grilled chicken paillards and salmon and like.
But it's busy and
oh
it's
my
a stoke.
God, it was busy and yeah. I just fucking loved it. Right. I turned, man, and like. At that point, I started getting knowledge. Like, the chef was like, man, you're good. And then, like, the corporate chef was like, we're opening a restaurant in Miami. Come be a sous chef. And, like, at that point, I was like, this is my career. I'm doing it. And, like, but I also was very involved in 12-step programs. So, I, like, you know, I made sure to stay in the middle of everything. And I got involved with service and giving back. And, you know, that, you know, the mm-hmm. 12 steps for me is what I need. That's my insulin, you know.
And you came to New York to work with Gordon Ramsay.
Right. So, eventually, took a job with Gordon Ramsay in New York.
I love the chicken story where you're boning out the chicken. We can't use you. You're cutting the skin. Nobody freaking told me I couldn't break their
eyes. Well, no. Are you kidding? I came from South Florida. It was like – I've seen every ingredient. I've can deal with the volume. I'm a good cook, but finesse, technique. It was like New York was a new experience for me.
Well, it is.
And oh my God, I loved it. I culinary boner all the way, you know. And so yeah, working at Gramsci was amazing. You know, I staged at Perse. I went around on my days off and go to John George, wherever I can go to like get in the kitchen and learn. And I sucked it in, and then I started hustling like that same thing.
Steve Earle, the musician. Earle, I love the guy. Great alt-country guy, a legend. He was sort of a Townes Van Zandt, the disciple, and Townes, unfortunately, drank himself to death. And Steve was an addict. And Terry Gross, Steve went on, he got clean, 12-step program. He was in that movie. He was in the show The Wire. He wrote books. But Terry Gross had an interview, and she said, "So where do you get all the energy?" And he just didn't miss a beat. He said, "Terry, when you're an addict, you wake up in the morning and you spend all fucking day to figure out how I can get the $500 I need to get my head straight.
Right.
Not having to do that? You kidding me? I got energy to burn."
But it's crazy because my wife, my coworkers, my, you know, people that work for me, they can't believe it. My father, like, they see it's just like, even my partners are like, you know, like, I'm just like a machine. I wake up in the morning and it's like, I'm interviewed to here, to there, to cooking, to prepping, to parties, blah, blah, blah. You know, and by 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, when a normal person's day ending, I first have to go work the service, you know, and I do it all night, and then I'm home and I'm thinking and I'm working. It's like, and like my wife said, I can't keep up with you. Like, it's just so much. And I, you know, but like, it's what I do. It's who I am.
That sort of manic behavior that in one way obsessed itself with addiction.
Yes.
Free of the addiction, it gives you the energy to just be super guy.
Exactly.
Super chef guy. Super chef dad guy.
I have thick skin. It's like, it's hard, you know, like I, you know, I what would affect one person may not affect me the same way, you know? So by 27, I opened Reset. I mean, I just pushed for it. You know, I raised money for it.
You were doing those things. You had that. You were working in New York. You were doing private dinners up in Harlem.
Yeah.
Word got around, you got the investors you needed, and then you took over a spot that wasn't, I mean, the Village isn't so easy to break into, and that corner had been kind of a middle-level bistro, Brasserie Cognac, it was called, or something. Right. I remember I ate there once, and I didn't go back. I mean, I can cook that shit at home. What, right, you know, right, I'm going to pay for this? And the room wasn't great, and the rent wasn't cheap, and the kitchen sucked.
Yeah.
And you went in there, and roll of the dice, and I remember you worked your ass off. You guys were there all the time. And the early criticisms that I was getting from people were the same stuff you always hear. The plates are too small. It's too expensive. Like, chef's trying to cook. Just how was the food? What did the plate say? And then Sifton came in 2 stars.
Sifton came in and set it straight. And, like, basically rocking in my career. I mean, I'm forever grateful for that guy. I mean, he wrote exactly what I was trying to do.
Right, they got it right. Every so often, the Times writes a review that I agree with, and I'm like, oh, they got that one right.
Yes, yes.
Now, what about the other 8? You know? But whatever, as long as they get right. That's the power of that. So the Gander, talk about the concept there, and they do lunch at the Gander. If you're listening, you live in New York and you work near Union Square, they do a great lunch at the Gander. So talk about the menu. I loved it. So let's talk about that one dish. Break down that one dish for me. That would be really neat.
All right.
So you have this ranch dressing squid dish. The inspiration is hysterical. Tell me where that came up with.
So the inspiration, basically, I was thinking about lunch and being a neighborhood restaurant. What do people love? What do you crave? What do you want to have every day? So for some reason, I morphed back to like Cheesecake Factory chopped chicken salad with like the fried chicken, the cashews, the fried, you know, the Asian creamy Asian dressing, the romaine, the cabbage, the crunchies, all the textures.
China Grill has some dish like that on their menu, I'm sure.
Something, too. One of those things you just eat, just like you just can't get enough of it.
Right.
So I wanted to create something like that. So I was going to do this fried calamari salad. And so we basically fried calamari, very traditional, the cornmeal batter, buttermilk, whatever. And then chiffonade romaine, grapes.
Sweet.
Sweet grapes.
Crunch.
Cashews.
Nuts.
Radishes.
A little heat. Another crunch.
Snap peas.
Yeah.
And ranch dressing. And ranch. But
that everybody loves. I mean, who doesn't like ranch dressing?
And then the kicker is we pickle eggs that we then put through the dressing.
I didn't know that.
And a lot of dill. Yeah, so we basically take whole eggs, we boil them, we shell them, and then we pickle them.
It's an addictive salad, man. I mean, the whole menu is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, my son went back. I took him there. He had dinner there, and he came back with his girlfriend.
Awesome.
He's kind of a picky eater. South Jersey girl, you know, lives in Cape May all her life, hasn't exposed. I mean, I take her out to eat, and I'm like, Julie, can you eat anything on this menu? She says, not, we'll leave.
Right,
but
right.
No, he took his girl there, and they loved it. So
the Gander for me was, I wanted to open something that I wanted to open a restaurant that that was everything the Reset wasn't. Reset is 35 seats. It has no lunch. It has no bar. It has no private dining room. It's in a very residential area. Right. Now, Reset is my laboratory. I cook. It's very gastronomic. A lot of tasting menus, small plates, you know, premium ingredients. We take ourselves very serious. But the Gander is equally as serious. The ingredients are equally as pristine. But I want it to be more of a neighborhood place.
Yeah, I'd
I
say
wanted
the word
the
accessible
business.
Is what comes to mind to me.
Yeah.
You're just casting a broader net.
Yeah.
It's a bigger menu. We can pick around stuff. You're right. Not signing up for a tasting thing. Right. You can go in and have a burger at the bar. You can do the salad thing, which is a wonderful lunch option.
Yeah,
yeah, it's great. And your business is solid. I'm so glad for it.
Yeah. No, it's great. I always say, like, the Gander's a place to go if you want, like, an amazing steak and great bottle of wine, or like a great bowl of pasta, and if you want like a crazy tasting menu, go to Reset. You know,
who? Well, I like both of those options. This is a great story. So, I'm not going to ask you for advice for parents because you're a parent. Congratulations on your kids, by the way.
Thank you very much.
It's a great read. So again, this issue of addiction in our country, which seems to be only treatable by incarceration, because we don't. We don't invest in drug therapies.
No.
All the rehab doctors are COD. Yeah. So unless you have wealthy parents who are willing to funnel up and pay for that, I mean, it's just nuts. You're so screwed. So it's a great book, and thanks for writing it and turning a light on a topic that really kind of gets put underneath the rug, I think, all the time. Nobody wants to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's more people suffering from addiction than there are cancer patients in this country.
There's a number. That's nuts. Yeah. That's crazy. The name of the book's All or Nothing, One Chef's Appetite for the Extreme. The author is Jesse Shanker. If you if it touched a nerve, get the book. It's a great story. It's your hair will stand up. If you have family members or loved ones that have had addiction problems, it'll tell the story from Jesse's eyes. And on a food note, if you happen to be in New York and you like great food, Reset's a wonderful restaurant on that sort of high-end scale of tasting menus and haute cuisine. And the Gander, it no less haute in any way, but a little more accessible, fun, bigger room, kind of convivial, great, great place in Midtown. You're listening to Michael Michael's Food Talk. We'll be back next week with more of this. I never remember who my guests are, but we've got two more on the dais that are going to be wonderful. So stay tuned for that. Take care, and thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.